What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Okay, so we are walking.
We are walking into the Stan Spiro Fieldhouse in Manchester, aka the Bernie Sanders primary night rally spot. And there are a lot of people lined up outside, despite the fact that it is very cold and snowy on the ground. So we're expecting a very large crowd. The crowd is counting down. Crowd is loving these numbers. Bernie Sanders absolutely in the lead. Something's happening. Taking the stage right now. Seems very triumphant.
Thank you, New Hampshire. Thank you, New Hampshire.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, Bernie Sanders wins the New Hampshire primary with Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar following close behind him in second and third place, and Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden coming in a distant fourth and fifth place. Alex Burns on what that means for the rest of the race. It's Wednesday, February 12th. Okay. Alex, I'm pleased to be sitting with you, albeit at 12:15 a.m., because we actually have election results to discuss this time.
It's sort of a novel experience, right, for the 2020 campaign. They just count the votes, and the person who got the most votes is the guy who won.
And they count them on the same night as the election.
Right.
So I want to start at the top of the results today.
Let me take this opportunity,
Bernie Sanders,
to thank the people of New Hampshire for a great victory tonight.
On the one hand, that's the expected result, and it has been for months, right? And New Hampshire went for Sanders overwhelmingly in 2016 over Hillary Clinton. So how should we be thinking about the significance of this result tonight?
Look, there's no question that this is an important milestone for the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Let me say tonight that this victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
It reestablishes him clearly as the leader of the left wing of the Democratic Party, which was not sure to be the case at this point in the race. Mm-hmm. But you saw Elizabeth Warren really recede as a competitor and Bernie Sanders consolidate his support in a way that positions him pretty well for the next couple rounds of this thing. At the same time, you saw him come out on top with about 26% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
4 years ago, he won 60% of the vote here. Now, there are many, many more candidates running this time, so it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. But I do think that when you look at the results in both Iowa and New Hampshire, you see a majority of the Democratic electorate leaning towards those more moderate candidates, and Bernie Sanders prevailing mainly because there are more moderates than there are progressives.
Right, because one way of thinking about what happened tonight is that Bernie Sanders got around a quarter of the vote, 25%, and he won. But another way of thinking about it is that if you add up all the more moderate candidates' vote tonight, they collectively got something like 70% of the vote.
Right. Now, of course, for Bernie Sanders' purposes, winning is winning,
right?
But what that tells you is that as this race advances, if you end up with fewer and fewer moderate candidates, it could become harder and harder for Bernie Sanders to keep winning states.
Right, because those votes would likely coalesce around one moderate.
One or maybe two moderates compared to the 3, 4, or 5 moderate options we have had in the race up to this point. Sanders is going to need at some point to broaden his coalition within the Democratic Party. And, you know, delegate math is a boring and arcane subject.
Says who?
Well, I think that between friends, we can say that it's an arcane subject. But the way the Democrats hand out delegates, which are ultimately the point system that determine who gets to be the nominee, is really proportional to the share of the vote you get. So it's not like winning by 1 percentage point or 1.5 percentage point over Pete Buttigieg means you get all the delegates and he gets zero.
Mm-hmm. In other words, these kind of victories, 26% of the vote, means functionally you get something like 26% of the delegates. It doesn't mean you're collecting just a giant boatload in a state like New Hampshire or Iowa, for that matter.
Right. There's certainly a value in bragging rights and in momentum
of winning
and fundraising for just winning. But in terms of winning delegates to claim the nomination, a larger share of the vote matters almost as much as just actually winning.
Well, so when it comes to that question, to momentum, what does this mean for Sanders?
There is now an 11-day sprint for the candidates until the next contest in Nevada. And what Bernie Sanders now has is an opportunity to try to broaden his support and to try to go out and get some of those progressives who have been voting for Elizabeth Warren or some more working class voters who have been voting for Joe Biden and pull them into his camp and make himself more formidable as not just a really strong candidate, but as a front runner to take control of this race and to do it before one of those moderate alternatives catches up with him.
Right. Time here is of the essence for Sanders.
Right.
So let's talk about who is currently leading that moderate pack, Pete Buttigieg.
And I don't think you can beat what Pete's talking about. He may not win tonight, but number two, that keeps him going. And that's all we're looking for.
Who came in second tonight, just behind Sanders?
Buttigieg came into this state with a whole lot of momentum coming out of Iowa. And just looking at his events, at his crowds over the last week in New Hampshire, you could see a lot of support moving away from Joe Biden and into the Mayor Pete camp. And but for a couple moments in that debate last Friday, he might have won this state outright.
In this election season, we have been told by some that you must either be for a revolution or you are for the status quo. But where does that leave the rest of us? Most Americans don't see where they fit in that polarized vision. And we can't defeat the most divisive president in modern American history by tearing down anybody who doesn't agree with us 100% of the time.
You really saw him take a beating on the debate stage for the first time from every direction.
Senator Warren, is that a substantial answer from Mayor Buttigieg?
No.
Literally every other candidate on stage went after Mayor Pete.
Mayor Buttigieg is a great guy and a real patriot. He's a mayor of a small city who has done some good things, but has not demonstrated he has the ability to, and we'll soon find out, to get a broad scope of support across the spectrum, including African-Americans and Latinos.
And the one who probably went after him to the greatest effect was Amy Klobuchar.
We have a newcomer in the White House, and look where it got us. I think having some experience is a good thing.
Another moderate from the Midwest who went out there and made a very, very blunt case that he's just not qualified to be president.
It is much harder to lead and much harder to take those difficult positions, because I think this going after every single thing that people do, because it's popular to say and makes you look like a cool newcomer, I don't think that's what people want right now.
And you think that was effective? Or it just did enough to hurt him here?
Well, when you look at how Amy Klobuchar finished in New Hampshire, I don't want to jump the gun here, but she did pick up an enormous amount of momentum at the end. I think you do have to consider the strong possibility that a bunch of moderate voters who ended up with her after that debate would otherwise have been with Pete.
So it may have been Klobuchar and her gain here that cost Buttigieg a victory here.
I think that's pretty likely.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that she has really benefited from the decline of Elizabeth Warren, that there are a lot of voters out there who feel very strongly that they'd like to see a woman elected president, and particularly they'd like to see a woman go up against Donald Trump. And that was a big dynamic fueling Elizabeth Warren's rise. And I don't think that that demand has gone away. And part of what you saw here in New Hampshire was a lot of more moderate and older women who may have been drawn to Warren, but were concerned about whether or not she could win the general election, suddenly see this other alternative pop up, mm-hmm. who is a woman and a moderate and from the Midwest and has a much blunter electability argument in her arsenal.
And what exactly is that argument?
The argument is that she has won three statewide elections in Minnesota, which is on the verge of being a swing state.
Hmm. I'm the only one up on this stage, you can check it out, that has consistently won in red congressional districts. Not once, not twice, but three times.
And she likes to tick off, and she's very, very happy to do it, the list of the numbers of counties that voted for Donald Trump in 2016 that she then carried when she ran for re-election in 2018. It's a little bit of an oversimplified case because she had a pretty weak opponent in 2018. It's not like it was this Battle of the Titans thing that she somehow miraculously survived. But for voters, I think, especially outside the Midwest, this notion that you're from the part of the country that Democrats lost last mm-hmm. time is really appealing. I think it's also appealing to people when they hear Pete Buttigieg talking about his identity as a Midwesterner.
You're saying it should not be seen as a coincidence that two of the top three candidates here are Midwestern moderate Democrats.
No, absolutely not.
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So the results are still coming in from across the state, but right now it is clear that Senator Sanders and Mayor Buttigieg had strong nights.
Okay. Fourth up, Elizabeth Warren.
And I also want to congratulate my friend and colleague, Amy Klobuchar, for showing just how wrong the pundits can be when they count a woman out.
You said that Klobuchar benefited from her decline. But help us understand Warren's decline. She got 9% of the vote tonight, which was really pretty underwhelming.
So I think part of why Elizabeth Warren became such a strong candidate for a long period of time in this race was that she managed to get out from under Bernie Sanders' shadow. Because she got out there and defined herself so clearly in the eyes of Democratic voters as a daring leader, her own person, someone with big thoughts and big plans, she managed to appeal to a set of voters who weren't accessible to Bernie Sanders in 2016, may not be accessible to him today. Liberal women who voted for Hillary Clinton and other people who are pretty progressive, but not far left enough to feel comfortable going the full Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And she, for a while, was able to sort of straddle these worlds and look like she was somebody who could bring together these disparate parts of the Democratic coalition. And then she was forced in the early fall to really choose a side over this question of Medicare for All.
So yes, I'm with Bernie on Medicare for All. And let me tell you why. I spent a big chunk of my life studying why families go broke. And one of the number one reasons is the cost of health care, medical bills.
And her decision was to align herself far more closely with Bernie Sanders.
That leaves families with rising premiums, rising co-pays, and fighting with insurance companies to try to get the health care that their doctors say that they and their children need. Medicare for All solves that problem.
That made it much tougher for her to continue being this unifying figure within the party. I do think Elizabeth Warren is still, for a lot of Democratic voters, a compelling enough personality and thinker and communicator that she may be tougher to push out of this race than someone like, say, Bernie Sanders would like her to be. But it's really hard sitting here tonight to sort of draw the path back to frontrunner status for her.
Mm-hmm. Alex, what do you take away from what we've seen with Warren? What lesson is there when it comes to understanding the Democratic electorate and this race?
I think you see a really low tolerance for anything that they perceive as risk. I think you see that Democratic voters are in a really unforgiving mood when it comes to candidates who they see as making a mistake of any kind because they want a nominee who's a sure thing for the general election. I think you have consistently seen and heard from voters anxiety about the implications of nominating a woman, even as there is still a lot of excitement about that idea. And I think you've seen the difficulty that candidates have had really up until the last week or so at carving out a durable space for themselves in a race where you have had, on the one hand, Bernie Sanders as this really tenacious leader on the left and Joe Biden as, until recently, a pretty dominant figure on the political center.
When you say low tolerance for risk, I guess I'm not understanding that. What makes them a risk?
Well, in the eyes of voters, the notion that somebody could make a big misstep in a debate is sort of anathema to Democrats at this point. The idea that somebody could fumble a big policy question when the hot lights are on, I think, is a hard thing for Democratic voters to process. And I think that you do see sort of pretty conventional assessments of people's electability kick in as we get closer to primaries. So, coming from Massachusetts, not as appealing to somebody who's thinking about electability as coming from Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Somebody who maybe fits demographically a voter's idea of what a president looks like may be an easier sell than somebody who would be a historic candidate.
Well, I wonder if this low tolerance for risk, if that's also a way of understanding what happened to Joe Biden.
This is Tom Kaplan, and I'm at Joe Biden's election night party in Nashua. This is a pretty strange party in that Joe Biden isn't going to be here. He already left the state to go to South Carolina. He's supposed to address the party via live stream. It's fair to say the room here, it's not exactly buzzing with excitement. There's probably not going to be much to celebrate tonight if you're a Biden supporter.
We are in the battle for the soul of the nation. Now Jill and I are moving on to Nevada and South Carolina and beyond. And we want you all to know how much we appreciate everything you've done. Look, we're going to be back. We're going to be back in New Hampshire. We're going to be back there to defeat Donald Trump in November, elect Jeannie the next senator again, and up and down the ticket. So don't go away. You're not getting rid of us. We're coming back, and we love you. We're going on, and we're going to win in Nevada and in South Carolina. Thank you.
And I almost can't believe we're talking about the electability candidate, the guy whose ads declared him to be the one person who could beat Donald Trump, coming in fifth place here.
It's really staggering and such an abrupt decline for Biden in this race. I think for months, you heard this from voters over and over again, they were willing to give Joe Biden a pass on a lot of stuff that they would not have tolerated from other candidates because they did perceive him as the electability candidate, that if all they cared about was beating Donald Trump, then the fact that he wasn't so impressive in debates and his message wasn't so clear didn't really matter all that much to them, except to the voters who saw him the most up close, the people in Iowa and New Hampshire. And when you saw him come in fourth in Iowa, it set off just a devastating chain reaction in New Hampshire, that this was a guy who voters had already been suppressing a lot of anxieties about because they thought he could win, suddenly losing and losing pretty badly in the first state. And what has happened here just over the last 8 days is just a rushing of the air out of the balloon. His support has just scattered to other candidates, probably mostly Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar.
It felt like Biden knew this was coming. Right. He left New Hampshire today for South Carolina, didn't even stay for the results. I think he did some streaming video to a crowd here in Manchester. Is there a version of this where the story that Joe Biden has been putting forward.
This is the long race. I took a hit in Iowa, and I'll probably take a hit here. Traditionally, Bernie won by 20 points last time, and usually it's the neighboring senators that do well.
That these first two states do not represent his greatest strength and his possibility. That's accurate.
Absolutely. I don't think we can sit here right now and say Joe Biden is totally finished. I think we can say that he's entering by far the most difficult stretch of his campaign. Mm-hmm. There are already signs that Biden's support among Black voters may be more vulnerable than he hopes that it will be. But we're going to find out soon enough that he staked his claim pretty clearly on the idea that now the rest of the country, states that look like the country as a whole, Nevada and South Carolina, are going to have their say. And because he has put so much moral weight on those states, it would be very, very difficult, probably impossible, for him to shrug off another loss.
Okay, so you have brought us at long last to Mike Bloomberg. Help us understand how he fits into all this, particularly in light of what happened to Joe Biden tonight.
Well, when Bloomberg got into the race in November, what his advisors said was that he wasn't convinced that Joe Biden could make it out of the early states and that he wanted to essentially be waiting in March if Biden took a dive before then. And you ended up either with Bernie Sanders emerging from February as a front runner or just a jumbled split decision among the other candidates running.
How do you like that prediction?
Well, I think Mike Bloomberg likes that prediction quite a bit right now, that if the idea for Bloomberg was Biden had to fall for him to rise, at least half of that has happened now.
And so help me understand what their vision of this race is. He's not been on the ballot these first two states. Joe Biden is, as their prediction required, stumbling. So what needs to happen for the Bloomberg candidacy to take off?
The Bloomberg theory of the case is that as moderates at the national level shift away from Joe Biden, and as people who don't live in these small rural states tune into his television ads.
Mike Bloomberg started as a middle-class kid who had to work his way through college, then built a business from a single room to a global entity, creating tens of thousands of good-paying jobs along the way.
Check out his campaign appearances, that they will start to see him as the safe option in the race.
The electable guy.
Because there's an America waiting to be rebuilt, where everyone without health insurance is guaranteed to get it, and everyone who likes theirs can go ahead and keep it.
And there is some sign that that's already happening. There's at least some polling to suggest that a good number of moderate voters and a good number of Black voters are shifting at least somewhat in Bloomberg's direction. Mm.
This is Matt Stevens. I'm here at Andrew Yang's campaign party on primary night here in New Hampshire.
So finally, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the two candidates who dropped out tonight.
Mr. Yang is going to announce that he's dropping out of the race for president when he comes and gives his speech here sometime shortly after 8.
Well, we lost Andrew Yang and we lost Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado.
Though thousands of voters came out for our campaign tonight, tonight is not the outcome we fought so hard to achieve. And while there is great work left to be done, you know I am the math guy, and it is clear tonight from the numbers that we are not going to win this race. I am not someone who wants to accept donations and support in a race that we will not win. And so tonight I am announcing I am suspending my campaign for president.
Hi, my name is Gene Bishop. I live in Aston, New Hampshire. I'm 81 years old, and I've been a political junkie my whole life. And I never, ever, before Andrew came along, I never contributed to a candidate. I never worked for a candidate. But I saw him in March of 2018, 2019, and the first time I saw him, I knew he was something special, very, very different. And I had to do what I could to help him be successful. So I just can't believe that it's over.
Are you upset? Are you?
Yeah, very upset. I probably just as I'm being very selfish because he's probably very upset too. It was something that probably he never wanted to do, but it just hurts.
You think you'd ever get disconnected to a candidate where you'd feel this strongly when he drops out?
Never. No, never. He was a big part of my life.
I do think that when you look at the Andrew Yang experience, he is somebody who comes out of this race as a political player in a way that he was not at all 2 years ago, that he has a following. And when you talk to Democratic voters, even voters who, like most people, supported other candidates, there is like an interest in him and almost a certain affection for him, that he was often the most lighthearted character in a debate. And people liked the way he talked about the economy. Mm-hmm. And the question is, if he does want to stay in politics, what does he do with that?
Right. He seems to have cabinet member written all over him. If he wants it.
If he wants it.
What do we think happens to the Yang gang? Where do they go?
We don't really know, because he's one of these candidates, and it's a sort of genre of candidate that crops up from time to time who seems to draw on a constituency that isn't really partisan. It isn't ideological in the sense that we think of it. They're drawn to a candidate's personality and worldview and just sort of the way they talk about
things. I
think
of Ross Perot.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good comparison in a lot of ways. And do they go to another candidate? If it's anybody, it might be Bernie Sanders, because he does have this following of younger, disaffected liberal men that overlaps at least somewhat with the people supporting Yang. But a lot of them also may just sit out the rest of the primaries because they may have been drawn uniquely to Andrew Yang.
Mm-hmm. So it's now a little after 1 a.m. on Wednesday morning. We had this absolute mess of a situation in Iowa. We have a quite real result in New Hampshire. What is Alex Burns thinking beyond all the many thoughts that you have already shared with us?
We are still in a really, really muddled race. I think last week we talked about how 5 candidates in Iowa cracked double digits and nobody got more than about a quarter of the vote. Well, this time 3 candidates cracked double digits and their vote shares were a little bit higher, but you still don't have anybody here running away with the New Hampshire primary the way we saw both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump do in 2016. So there are still a bunch of people in this race who have a great chance to make their case, a couple people who have a less great chance to make their case, and then sort of Michael Bloomberg sitting out on the horizon. And I think the next 3 weeks are going to be some of the most unpredictable and fluid that certainly I've seen in presidential politics.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Here's what else you need to know today. 4 federal prosecutors have withdrawn from the case of Roger Stone, a longtime friend and advisor of President Trump, after senior officials at the Justice Department recommended a more lenient prison sentence for Stone. Stone was convicted last fall of trying to obstruct a congressional investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election, a conviction for which prosecutors had originally sought a 7 to 9 year sentence. But in a surprise filing on Tuesday afternoon, the Department of Justice called that recommendation excessive, prompting the prosecutors to leave the case in protest. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.